Over the past four decades, editor, journalist, and publishing entrepreneur Terry McDonald has been at the helm of some of the most influential centers of American journalism. From his early days at Outside through 10 years at Rolling Stone, Newsweek, Esquire, Sports Illustrated, and most recently as the co-founder of Literary Hub. In a memoir called The Accidental Life, an Editor's Notes on Writing and Writers, Mr. McDonald takes us behind the scenes of magazine publishing with revealing portraits of important and sometimes eccentric contributors like Hunter S. Thompson, George Plimpton, Richard Ford, Tom McGuane, Jim Harrison, and Edward Abbey. I spoke with Terry McDonald in August, and we're rebroadcasting that conversation for you now. Who was the best editor you encountered in your early days as a reporter?
Well, it was the editor who made me an editor. His name was Bob Sherrill.
But you call him the other Bob Sherrill.
Yes. He was the other Bob Sherrill because the other Bob Sherrill was a reporter who had done a book called Saturday Night Special, which was about handguns in America. This was in the early 70s, and it was such a brilliant book. The other Bob Sherrill said you just wanted to hold it up to your forehead to learn how to be a better reporter, a better journalist. And my Bob Sherrill had his history was that he had been an editor at Esquire during that genre-cracking time under Harold Hayes when the new journalism had really exploded. And he had been responsible for things like the Dubious Achievement Awards, and he had packaged just these miraculous pieces, edited Tom Wolfe, did all kinds of interesting work. And he left that and came out to California to be the managing editor of what was then called an underground newspaper. It was a startup. And I worked for him there.
It was like the Village Voice in Los Angeles.
We used to say that. We used to say, you know, we're like the Village Voice except for Los Angeles, which really made no sense if you thought about it, but it made us feel better.
And since you were a reporter, were you watching what the editors did? I mean, how did that lead to you becoming an editor?
Well, what Bob unlocked to me was the not very secret. That editing is really about ideas. And so talking with him, riding around Southern California in my car, just talking about what was a story and what was not, lit me up because it seemed like anything was possible.
You quote Norman Cousins, the legendary editor of the Saturday Review, as saying, "Nothing is more ephemeral than words. Moving them from the mind of the writer to the mind of the reader is one of the most elusive and difficult undertakings ever to challenge the human intelligence. This is what being an editor is all about." Is that something you keep in mind when you're editing someone else's work?
Well, I was so moved by the nuance and clarity of that language that I wrote to him, Editor Cousins, because I had just become an editor and I thought we would have some editor-to-editor back-and-forth relationship. But I never heard back from him. He was clearly too busy, and that's when my joke is that I felt like a writer again. An editor had not written back to me.
But one of my great thrills is he was a guest on the show many years ago. Part of the fun of editing, I imagine, is also the face-to-face with some of the writers you've admired over the years. What happened with Edward Abbey?
Well, we were launching Outside Magazine, and Ed Abbey had written a book called The Monkey Wrench Gang, which was a kind of a Bible for the radical environmental movement as it was coming together then. I'm talking about Earth First and Sea Shepherd, things like that, groups like that. And so he was perfect to write about this new environmental, you know, turmoil. And I knew, because I had been a great fan of Desert Solitaire, that he was like a poet when it came to describing, you know, the emotional impact and just how it felt to be connected to nature in a way that most people never get to be because they're not out there alone. So I wanted him in Outside Magazine, and I could not. He didn't have a phone. So I got an address at a post office box. I think it was an Oracle. And I sent him a postcard and said, "Whatever you want to do, please call me. Collect." And he did. He called me collect from a bar. I remember the bar was in Moab, but the post office box was not. And he said, "Well, the last thing I need is another editor, but I guess I could use some more money. And our relationship started with that.
Do you, as an editor, often suggest ideas to writers based on what you think their interests are?
Always. It was the way that you can show an editor that you show a writer that you're engaged with that writer and his or her work is to launch ideas at them that is into their various sweet spots.
But what happens when you're editing someone like Edward Abbey, who writes beautifully? I remember reading about an editor of Faulkner in the later years who was intimidated against even telling him that the book had begun with hyphenated words and ended with compound words because you just don't tell William Faulkner that he's being inconsistent.
Well, I had a face where I would present to writers the idea that I was pretty much there just to get thorns out of paws. I was just going to be a helpful guy, and I would have some ideas. But the truth was I would always ask for more, and asking for more put us together we were braiding something together.
What about working with someone like Hunter S. Thompson? What were the circumstances of your first working with him?
I met Hunter at what he would call a peace riot. It was a demonstration outside of the Century Plaza Hotel in Los Angeles when Nixon was celebrating his victory in the presidential primary, whatever, and he was going to run against McGovern, and it was awful. And anyway, Hunter was in the lobby smoking, and I remember that he looked sad, and I told him that, and that it sort of sparked something. And then years later, when I was at Rolling Stone, I talked him back into the magazine, but we had a relationship for a lot of years, although he would say that he had suffered mightily at the grotesque failures of incompetent editors, he knew he needed an editor.
Was he as eccentric as he presented himself to be?
Oh yeah, he was way out there, but there were sides of him that most people did not see. He was very courtly sometimes. And if he wanted you to like him, he could be as charming as anyone I ever saw.
What can you tell us about the round of golf you played with Hunter S. Thompson and George Plimpton? That seems like an odd threesome.
Well, Hunter and George were great friends. They recognized each other immediately and as potential allies, and they became allies. Their most important books came out almost on top of each other. The Hell's Angel book and George's Paper Lion. But when I was starting Smart Magazine, George decided that he wanted to begin a series of interviews of the journalist at work, like the writer at work things he does at the Paris Review. And right at that moment, I got a postcard from Hunter of him sinking a putt in Aspen, and written across the top of it was to come out here and bring George and bring money. I'll beat you like mules. And we went out to play golf with Hunter, but really to do an interview for the Paris Review. And the first night we got out there on the course, and we had the cart was loaded with all of Hunter's supplies, which, included everything for his Cuervo, his Heineken, his Jack Daniels, his Wild Turkey, and his 12-gauge shotgun, and some doers for George. And we were about to start, and he handed us some blotters with a strange logo on it. He says, "Here, eat these." And, of course, it was acid. Mm-hmm. And
did you play golf?
Yeah. So
stoned on acid?
Yeah, we did.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Terry McDonnell, who's written a memoir called The Accidental Life, an editor's notes on writing and writers. In the case of Plimpton, you worked with him on Sports Illustrated, so many of those sports things that he wrote. But he, as you mentioned, he was the editor of the Paris Review for 50 years. Didn't people ask why he devoted so much time to the Paris Review when he could have given that time over to just writing?
Yes, they did, and he would bristle at that. And he, I believe, never got the credit that was due him for the fine, fine work that he did as a journalist. And that was enough, is what he would say.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a fine editor, although he was prickly, and it was a tough edit on both sides of the desk as an editor and a writer.
Well, in preparing for this show, I edit other people's work, but then when I write my own things, I feel that somebody should edit me, that it's not the same thing to edit someone else's. I see all the flaws in other people's writings, but I don't see any of the flaws in my own.
I believe you're a very healthy man.
Have you had that same experience?
Absolutely. I mean, it just gets better. I mean, people can step on your stuff and make you feel sad or cranky or whatever. But another practicing intelligence, going through your thinking, is just always good from my point of view.
Your first issue as managing editor at Rolling Stone coincided with the shooting death of John Lennon in December 1980. Lennon was good friends with the magazine's founder, Jan Wenner. What do you remember about working on that issue?
Well, there would never have been a Rolling Stone, I do not believe, without John. He was on the cover of the first issue, and Jan Wenner loved John and was a very, very important person to him for many, many reasons. And it was just such a tragic and, you know, horribly bloody play out of this crime, and we were reporting it. And I remember being in Jan, we were across the table from each other talking about what we were going to do, and I remember describing to him what we knew about the actual shooting, because we had a reporter whose uncle lived inside the Dakota where John had been killed, and I told him how bloody and awful it was, and he turned away, and it was that moment.
You were involved with a lot of big issues at Rolling Stone. One, the controversial cover that featured Jim Morrison with the headline, "He's hot, he's sexy, he's dead." Who came up with that headline?
And that's a good question.
In poor taste, despite the fact that it was true.
it was our most successful cover. It got picked up everywhere. It sold a ton of issues. And David Rosenthal, who was my deputy then, says that he wrote it. Mm-hmm. Jan Wenner says that he wrote it, and I seem to recall that I wrote it, but it was in that mix.
Well, maybe you collaborated.
Well, I remember David and I were, you know, knocking things around. We had a competition to see who could be most like the, you know, a Looney Tunes character who pulls a stick of dynamite out from behind your back with a lit fuse. That was what writing headlines was like there. So we had something, and then we told Jan what we were doing, and he says at that point he added he's dead, but I don't know.
Do you think that the covers of magazines were sold more magazines in the old days than they do now?
Absolutely. The newsstand, as I knew it, is no longer exists.
The lead of a story is also equally important. Do you have any advice?
Be good. You have to get
people's
attention.
I read some articles, I think, get to the point, whereas others, maybe too much is thrown at me right away, and then I'm just slogging through all of the detritus that follows.
You can't repeat anything. You just have to be fresh, whether it's the rhythm, the content, or just the surprise quality of the language and the subject matter.
In this case, you're writing about a book about your experiences, but not very much about your own life. Did you find yourself editing yourself out?
Yes, I edited some things out, but I didn't write that much about myself to begin with. My original idea was that I would be able to show myself as a writer by writing about other writers in a very wild and woolly time.
But you're telling us something about yourself by calling this book An Accidental Life.
Oh, I am in the book.
and you think that becoming an editor was something that was accidental? Is that usually the case? Was Maxwell Perkins an accidental
editor? I don't know. I think that there are career paths that people set out with from the beginning, and they're going to go from here to there. And this was the thing that the other Bob Sherrill, who the editor of Made Me an Editor, talked about all the time, how you cannot do that. You cannot have soaring joy unless you're free to bounce around a little bit.
You say that the only other editor at Sports Illustrated who lasted longer than you was the guy who came up with the swimsuit edition idea. Is being an editor at a magazine a transient job on the usually?
Absolutely. It's at Newsweek we called ourselves the Walindas because we were famous for such sudden falls from heights.
And that was because you screwed up, or because?
Yeah, yeah. You could.
Who made that decision that you'd screwed up?
Another editor,
or somebody who was higher up on the totem pole.
Yeah, or whoever was running the company would put an editor in to replace you. You know, it's a tightrope up there.
So when you're looking for a job, people don't, when they're looking at editors' resumes, they don't say, you never lasted at any job more than 3 years?
No one ever said that to me. Of course, I was always lucky enough to be recruited out of one job into another, and that was good. I like that. That's how you kept score in a way, if you kept score with money.
And you worked with a lot of the people you mentioned earlier who were connected to the new journalism movement. It was a very male-dominated group of writers. Was there any room for women in it?
Well, I think we think of it as male-dominated because of how it was sort of passed on to us that it was. And there were all these, you know, men writers. But you cannot forget Gloria Steinem, who was right in there. And Joan Didion is the most important writer to me, bar none. And she is absolutely in that same new journalism.
Did you edit her?
Never did. Tried many times. She just was always busy, and we're doing her other work.
It sounds to me like you were chasing after a lot of writers that you were hoping to work with. What excuses did they give you other than not answering your call?
Well, the funny part about that is if I could get to them, I usually got them. Joan was an exception there. And I'll tell you, she is her manners are impeccable, but she is not a big fan of ass-kissing.
What do you see as the future for print journalism, and now that digital has changed things so much?
Well,
we've been hearing about the death of newspapers and magazines for a long time. Some have died.
Yeah, and more will die, but some will stay with us. The physical properties of a magazine I still love. I still love the idea of magazines as a place where conceptual news can land all in one place for you. It's just not fast enough anymore. So I want other things too. And I believe in magazine content as I used to build it out on all platforms now. That's what I did at Sports Illustrated, and that's what I do now.
And now you also run the website Literary Hub.
Well,
so
I don't.
You've joined the enemy?
I was always very early into all that digital stuff. That was my passion since I met Steve Jobs, and we did the first desktop magazine way, way back.
I should point out that your 1980s novel, California Bloodstock, is being reissued by Vintage Contemporaries. You going to write another novel?
I don't know. I conceived of that first one as the first of two, but I got sidetracked.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me here.